You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the third of four podcasts on ulcerative colitis hosted by Med Learning Group, titled Histologic Remission as a Treatment Target in Ulcerative Colitis. Is it ready for prime time? My name is Dave Chapman, your host for this podcast series. The series is intended to meet the educational needs of gastroenterologists, pathologists, nurse practitioners, and PAs who treat patients with ulcerative colitis. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ryan Ongaro, MD, Associate Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Joining Dr. Ongaro is Dr. Alexei Poliouridis, MD, PhD, Professor and Vice Chair for Clinical Research in the Department of Pathology, Molecular and Cell-Based Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. And he's also attending pathologist in the Division of Gastrointestinal Pathology at Mount Sinai Hospital. In today's episode, they'll be discussing the clinical application of pathologic findings associated with moderate to severe ulcerative colitis. I'll now turn the program over to Drs. Ongaro and Poliouridis.
Great. Thanks, Dave. It's a real pleasure to be here. And it's great to be speaking with my colleague, Alexei Poliouridis, who's a expert gastrointestinal pathologist, and I think we're going to learn a lot speaking with him. Great to be talking with you, Alexei, and I guess I'll just kick off with the first question. Could you discuss some of the clinical pathologic characteristics that you see in ulcerative colitis that help you determine if a patient has disease activity and gives you a sense of how active their disease is histologically?
Great to be talking to you, Ryan, about these topics that I think are of increasing interest to a lot of people, pathologists, gastroenterologists, surgeons, and patients. So as you know, ulcerative colitis is a subtype of inflammatory bowel disease that is clinical pathologically defined as a diffuse inflammation of the colonic mucosa, starting from the rectum and then extending in a retrograde and continuous fashion anywhere proximal to that. So what one sees under the microscope, particularly in endoscopic biopsies from patients with ulcerative colitis, is what is described as an active chronic colitis. And what this definition means basically is that it encompasses the two important histologic characteristics that are observed in ulcerative colitis, that is, the chronicity, which refers to long-standing inflammatory damage of the mucosa, and the activity, which is basically how active, how severe the damage is at this point in time, meaning at the time of biopsy. So in a sense, chronicity, which includes histologic findings like architectural distortion or what is referred to as full thickness lymphoplasmacytosis of the lamina propria, particularly its basal aspect of that, that is what defines the biopsy as being characteristic of a chronic inflammatory disease of the colon, and therefore it's compatible with UC. Activity, on the other hand, concerns the amount of neutrophils present, and that determines, in a way, how bad, how active the disease is. And so it gives you a way of grading the disease activity.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Alexei. That was a helpful overview of the features that you look for on histology to assess disease activity in ulcerative colitis. You know, one thing that has come up as a clinical gastroenterologist, something that I find sometimes tricky to discern and understand, are the variety of assessment tools that are out there now for assessing patients' histologic status, such as the Nancy Index or the Robarts Index. And I was wondering, as a pathologist, do you have a preference for one or the other, or what do you see as the differences and the major potential tools out there for assessing histology that are being used in clinical practice or more just for research at this point?
Yeah, so these are assessment tools that basically help us evaluate and communicate to gastroenterologists like yourself the findings under the microscope in a systematic way. And mostly what we are concerned here is the amount and type of inflammation present in the tissue. And these are mostly developed and used in endoscopically obtained mucosal biopsies. So these histologic scoring systems or indices are generally of two types. First, there are those that are more what are called basically composite scores, such as the Riley score and the Roberts histopathologic index that you mentioned. And these are pretty detailed accounts of 4 to 6 histologic components, and each one of those components gets assigned a grade. And then the final score is basically calculated by adding up the grades of all the different components. So you end up with a number on a scale of 0 to 24 for the Riley score and 0 to 33 for the Roberts index. So as you can imagine, these are very thorough and comprehensive indexes and scoring systems and are probably ideally suited for research purposes, since you can distinguish and delineate even minimal changes or differences in outcomes. But they also, as a result, are very cumbersome and time-consuming and kind of difficult to apply during everyday routine clinical practice. You know, it will take quite some time to evaluate all these components and come up with a score. And also because there are a lot of different variables, they end up having a pretty high inter-observer variability. So eventually, even for those, if the goal is to apply a certain, dichotomous distinction point in terms of clinical decision-making, you would need a cutoff in those scoring systems where you would say, below which you may reduce or withhold treatment or lower the frequency of surveillance or consider the patient as having remission, et cetera. So even in those scoring systems that have a large scale, you might need to assign cutoffs. The second type of scoring system, which includes the Gibbosh score and the Nancy index, are what are called hierarchical, meaning that they are levels that are considered increasingly of more significant disease state. And with each level, you might have a subgrade, but basically if you reach the histologic characteristics of the higher level, then you move on to that level, et cetera. So these are much easier to learn and remember and much simpler to apply clinically. There are fewer possible grades, and so the inter-observer agreement tends to be higher as well. They're also much more straightforward to interpret in terms of having an actual, a pretty compact grading scheme with levels that pretty much mirror a grading rubric that calls disease mild, moderate, or active, or severely active. And therefore, it's a little bit easier to make clinical decisions based on that. It's important to note that none of these histologic grading schemes have been completely and systematically validated in terms of assessing each one of these individual components, measuring exact intra and inter-observer variability, and correlating specifically to patient outcomes. But the Roberts index and the Nancy index are probably the closest to being clinically validated, at least in terms of outcomes for patients. So in terms of the limitations, some of them I mentioned already in terms of how complicated they are and how time-consuming they may be. I think we're very close to accepting the Nancy index as probably the best system for clinical use. There was a recent echo position paper that basically endorsed the view that the Nancy index is probably the most easy to apply and useful for clinical decision-making. And this is probably likely to endure, especially if there is some more fine-tuning to the Nancy index. I think it's probably going to be the one that's going to, win over the rest of them, mostly because it has been validated to a certain extent, at least in terms of mirroring the results from the Gibbosh score as well as being pretty easy to apply and also being correlated with some outcomes. So specifically for the Nancy index, I think there are some other limitations or some fine tuning that might need to be dealt with, such as, for example, the amount of neutrophils or activity present, it's more labeled as moderate, mild, moderate, or severe. So that will probably need some sort of specific cutoff, like a 50%, say, of the epithelium being involved by neutrophils, which is something that the Gibbosh score, the original Gibbosh score actually had. But those are sort of small points, but I think we're pretty close to accepting the Nancy index as one of the better ones and the easiest to apply. And it would be actually a major advantage to have all pathologists using a single histologic grading scheme, since it would streamline and standardize both clinical decision-making about treatment and surveillance, but it will also allow comparison of patients across different institutions or different population cohorts, since the same or a very similar histologic grading system will be used. So you will be able to compare results from different research groups and clinical trials in a much easier fashion. What we use at Mount Sinai is pretty much something that's very close to it's our own homebrew system. It's very close to the Nancy index. And I think with some of the fine tuning that will be occurring over time on the Nancy index, we'll be very close to actually using the exact same one. So I guess that's my answer about what is my favorite one or what I've been using in my practice here.
That's great. That was very helpful. And for me, since I get to work with you, whatever you think is the best one, I'm happy with at this point for clinical decision making. And that leads me to actually a question about something that we see reported occasionally on biopsies, are that sometimes we see patients have eosinophilia or eosinophils in their biopsies in UC. And I was just wondering, you know, what role do you feel this finding eosinophils plays when you're assessing UC histologically? And, you know, does that change your assessment of the histologic status of a patient if you see eosinophils, or is it not really a major player at this point?
Eosinophils are sort of a peculiar finding because they can be seen in tissue samples from organs throughout the body. And the differential diagnosis, you know, meaning the different reasons or causes that you might see eosinophils include things, allergy, infection with parasites, for example, or even the effect of certain medications. So they have a very broad sort of differential or list of reasons why they might be occurring. In the setting of IBD, there's still, I think, a lot of uncertainty in terms of what role they play, both in terms of pathogenesis and whether they contribute to actually mucosal damage, but also in terms of whether they are implicated in the phenotype and therefore whether they should be a target to look for when you're assessing the patient's response to treatment. And in fact, in that echo paper that I mentioned, there was agreement among participants that eosinophils alone should not be used as a marker of histologic activity in UC. There was a recent paper in the Journal of Crohn's and Colitis that suggested that eosinophils may help predict a relapse, but that was only in patients that otherwise had no other histologic activity, meaning no neutrophils. So there may be sort of a subcategory or subgrade. In fact, the Gibosh score actually includes the measurement of eosinophils in the scoring system, but the NANSI index, for example, does not. So there may be a measure of activity or a certain level of maybe subacute activity in IBD, but I don't think we're ready for having them be included as a target for histologic remission, for example, or as a major player in determining how active the disease is. And there's a couple of other reasons for that as well. Because they're sort of newly described, you know, and it's the same thing with other tissues as well. Eosinophilic esophagitis is a fairly recent sort of clinical diagnosis that's becoming more popular and more prevalent as we discover more patients with it. But in the colon, you know, the cutoff number of eosinophils that is required to indicate an increased amount is not very well understood yet. The studies have not really determined what the exact number should be because some of them are normally present. So that's the difference with neutrophils, which are always abnormal in the colon. And there are some other issues as well. There was an interesting paper that suggested that the number of eosinophils may actually vary with the season of the year or with the geographical location. And that probably reflects sort of a component of an allergic reaction. So therefore, it would be difficult to establish standards, you know, across the board in terms of what's a high number of eosinophils. So there's still some more work to be done for eosinophils before they're considered part of what needs to be targeted in these patients, I think.
Great. Thanks, Lexi. That makes a lot of sense. And I was wondering, you know, something that we're always concerned about in our ulcerative colitis patients is risk of neoplasia. And, you know, in our surveillance colonoscopies, we're frequently doing often many, many biopsies in patients for dysplasia surveillance. And so I just wondering if you could give us a, you know, general quick overview of how you see histologic disease activities association with the risk of neoplasia in UC.
It has been well established that patients with ulcerative colitis are at an increased risk of developing colorectal neoplasia, particularly after 8 to 10 years of active disease. And this risk is related to the anatomic extent of the disease, the time that's elapsed since the initial diagnosis of UC, and importantly, the severity of the mucosal inflammation. So disease remission has been the goal as one of the ways to reduce the risk burden of colorectal cancer in these patients. So in fact, higher histologic activity scores in UC actually predict a higher likelihood of neoplasia development. And in some studies, histologic activity was a better predictor of neoplasia than endoscopic inflammation. And it seems that it's probably a measurement of histologic activity over time, sort of a cumulative score, and that is probably a more useful predictor than a single score or a single flare of activity. So that's the connection between histologic activity and disease activity and the risk of neoplasia. So the best surveillance tool there is for the identification and prevention of colorectal neoplasia in this setting is the endoscopic recognition and subsequent removal of the precursor lesion, which is epithelial dysplasia. And the interesting point here is that histologic activity, besides being a risk factor for the development of dysplasia and carcinoma, can actually hinder its identification, both endoscopically and histologically. So if you have a very active diseased mucosa in the colon, it's harder to identify lesions that might be dysplastic, both in terms of endoscopy, when you're looking for them during the colonoscopy, but also in biopsies, histologically, when we look at them, active inflammation can often interfere with tissue interpretation and make us unable to unequivocally diagnose or exclude presence of dysplasia. So we use terms like indefinite for dysplasia, which are a little bit difficult to deal with because by definition, they mean that we're not certain. So one of the goals or one of the incentives actually to achieve disease remission in these patients would be to reduce the histological obstacles that would prevent us from clearly identifying and diagnosing dysplasia.
This is a little more looking to the future. Do you see a role for any predictive biomarkers that may be helpful in determining which patients could respond to therapy? Kind of helping us with precision medicine. Anything on the horizon or anything that you see some emerging data on potentially, you know, pathologic or histologic markers that might potentially help us decide if a therapy is working for a patient or not, or predict who's going to respond to a therapy?
Yeah, so that's an extremely interesting question, both for research purposes as well as obviously for clinical decision-making and patient prognosis. So it would be ideal to have a way to predict response to certain therapies and stratify patients according to the treatment that is most likely going to be beneficial to them clinically. And you can categorize biomarkers as sort of any finding that could help stratify patients. And in a way, histologic activity is one of those biomarkers in determining which patients are likely to benefit with certain treatments as well. There's other biomarkers, as you know, of course, that may be found in the stool, such as fecal calprotectin, that it functions more like a real-time monitor of disease activity and response to the treatment being given in real time, rather than a priori predictor of which patient will respond to what treatment. So, you know, conceivably, one can imagine a test, you know, like a tissue stain or even a level in the serum that would measure the particular amount of a therapeutic target of a medication, and so determine whether that treatment is likely to be successful. That's kind of similar to what we do in oncologic pathology in carcinoma diagnosis, where we determine whether certain tumors express, so HER2 or PD-L1, and therefore are more likely to benefit from treatments targeting these molecules. So maybe, you know, you can imagine in the future that could be, we would be assessing whether the mucosa of patients with IBD is expressing certain molecules that are targeted by therapies. You know, for example, the integrin molecule that's the target of a monoclonal antibody could be measured in tissue or in the serum in order to establish whether treatment is likely to be successful with a therapy that targets that molecule. And I think there are maybe some early sort of data in that respect. So a lot more is happening in that horizon, of course, and that's something of huge activity in terms of research. Interestingly, we've had some very interesting new findings in coming out of the Sarah Mahandra's lab for which we participated and helped with, where it seems that the mode of action of vedolizumab may be through the reduction in the size of aggregation and formation of lymphoid aggregates in the colonic mucosa. And that can be observed fairly early in the course of treatment. So the hypothesis would be that we could monitor patients for this histologic effect as they're being treated in order to determine whether they are likely to respond or not to this treatment early on, and therefore tailor further treatment accordingly, or otherwise maybe look for alternatives.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Alexei, for all your insights here. This has been an especially informative an educational session. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but thanks again for your time and expertise, Alexei, and thanks to our audience for taking time to join us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great, thank you. This concludes our third in a series of four podcasts on ulcerative colitis. I want to thank our listeners for joining us, and also Dr. Zungaro and Pollaridis for their expertise. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our supporter, Lilly, who provided an educational grant for this activity.